Are you using your phone, or is it using you? Rise above mass surveillance and discover a phone that protects your privacy and communications. Above Phone does everything your old phone does, without tracking you, while giving you complete control over your phone and apps. We are better than big tech. It works with any cell service. No forced logins. No advertising or tracking. Download apps privately. Control your phone and its apps. Secure hardware.
Be sure to purchase Above Suite, our private communications and productivity suite that's run on our data center. You receive a VPN, email, calendar, video conferencing, encrypted chat, internet phone, and a search engine.
Don't worry if you're new. Every phone includes a free call with a real person to help you switch. You also get free email and chat support, free guides and video courses. We can take back our technology. We're here to help with tools and education. You have the power.
Rise above with Above Phone.
AbovePhone.com.
Welcome.
Free Thought Project Podcast.
I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
Hello again, free thinkers, and welcome back to the Free Thought Project podcast. My name is Jason Bassler, and joining me is the Free Thought Project editor-in-chief, Matt Agarest. Matt, it looks like our book had a pretty good launch debut last Thursday. We might need to write a few more books for our little free thinker series if people are this receptive.
Yeah, man, it's exciting. I'm glad that it was so well received. It definitely, like you said, it took a long time to make that book, and hopefully the next line in the series doesn't take 3 years to get out of here, you know.
No kidding. Yeah, as I mentioned last week, we hit every bump in the road, every hurdle. But you know, in case you missed it, we did officially launch our first ever children's book for kids 6 to 11 last week, and it's called Little Free Thinkers Know Your Rights. Its focus is to teach kids their rights and how to deal with law enforcement. And you know, we've been talking about this book in the opening the past three podcasts now, so I'll definitely keep this one short. But one thing we've learned after doing a decade of police accountability work with the Free Thought Project and Police the Police is that it's absolutely critical that we teach our kids their rights before police violate them. Now, I should probably also mention that this isn't a book that is going to create a lot of different explanations or educational side quests for your children, because it doesn't have a lot of terminology and or politics in it. So it's kind of like a gentle exploration of a challenging theme that should be taught and addressed from an early age to really build the foundation of understanding and respect, not only for our constitutional rights, but for our natural rights. And actually, this was pretty cool. I had someone yesterday message me and tell me that they were going to buy two, one for her own kids and another one to donate to her children's daycare. So yeah, guys, definitely check it out. It's at littlefreethinkers.com. We're really proud of it, and we're looking forward to writing more in the Little Free Thinkers line. So definitely check it out. But let's go ahead and move forward here and introduce our guest, who I'm not gonna lie, I've been really excited to talk to, but maybe also a little apprehensive. Our guest today might be one of the most controversial figures in the world of liberty and anarchism. And that's, you know, it's really no exaggeration. He's also an entrepreneur, an activist, the inventor and former CEO of Library, which is a decentralized open source blockchain based file sharing network, which has reportedly shuttered after a lengthy legal battle with the SEC, which I'm hoping to talk to him about today. He's also the founder of Odyssey, which is a video platform similar to YouTube, but without all the censorship and bullshit. And he's also a very vocal supporter and former board member of the Free State Project. So yeah, our guest today is Jeremy Kaufman. So Jeremy, thanks for joining us, and how you doing today?
Thanks. I'm doing great. I'm happy to be here. And, you know, it's far better to be regarded as controversial than uninteresting, I suppose, if, you know, if those are the two choices. But yeah, you know, like the truth is, and for people who haven't heard me on a podcast before, I like just, you know, having, you know, genuine discussions, you know, deep form, fair discussions, open-minded discussions. You know, Twitter is partially, what's the word, professional wrestling. You know, it's entertainment. It's a game. You go smash people with chairs, you know, and if you're playing a different game, you know, there, you're not going to win. You got to smash people with chairs on Twitter sometimes. But, you know, this kind of discussion, we get to have a nice, you know, relaxed, you know, nice exploration of ideas and concepts and this kind of thing.
Yeah, indeed. And we're definitely looking forward to it. I think our guest last week, Austin Peterson, called Twitter a slam dunk contest, at least with Dave Smith, which I found to be highly accurate. But as I noted in the opening, there's really a lot to talk to you about today. You have a lot of opinions, you make a lot of bold statements, and they tend to get people talking. And you don't seem confined to the Overton window, but instead you repeatedly shatter it. In fact, you were just mentioned last week in our podcast while talking to Austin Peterson. And it's funny that we have you on this week because you guys are kind of on the opposite ends of the spectrum on some topics. But we were talking about a recent Mother Jones article entitled "The Spectacular Implosion of the Libertarian Party." And they literally referenced you in the first line of the first paragraph of that article. And of course, referenced one of your most outrageous, albeit likely accurate tweet, which was, you know, John McCain's brain tumor saved more lives than Anthony Fauci. And then, you know, of course, they went on to, about your calls for like the legalization of child labor and repealing the Civil Rights Act, while effectively poisoning the well, of course, you know. So this is a bit of an extension, I guess, of our conversation with Austin last week, you know, where we thoroughly debunked this piece. We don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but I was kind of hoping to get your take on the article if you read it. And I guess maybe more of like the broader picture of like what your thoughts are on the future of the Libertarian Party. And of course, you know, after that, we could probably get into some stuff that are a little more relevant and timely, and might, but this might serve as like a good start to the conversation.
Yeah, I think that's great. I got to get a couple of things out quick. One is that the LPNH tweets were and are a team effort. Some of the ones you said weren't even written by me, so there are other people on the account. But in terms of, I can still address the question. Certainly, some of them are mine. I'll start with two. I have two things. One is, in terms of someone like Mother Jones writing about you, and you guys could feel free to feel differently about this, but I don't really want a Mother Jones reader coming into the Libertarian Party or coming to be. Coming to New Hampshire to be a part of the Free State movement, at least certainly not the typical Mother Jones reader. You know, so if Mother Jones is slandering me and attacking things that are, or maybe it's not literally slander, but you know, if they're defaming me, if they're attacking me, I'm okay with that. That's kind of what I want. And part of the strategy, you know, that I like is this sort of, you're trying to transform people's values. You're trying to show people that this other life, this other way of viewing things, this other reality is possible. And part of what allows you to show people that is to speak these sort of provocative truths, but to do it in a way, you know, to also, to, you know, to stand up and show that you can do it and to still be there. And that kind of thing, that is the kind of thing that actually can get through to people, because there's a real cost to speaking these, you know, provocative truths. But that cost becomes, makes that a signal, makes what you're speaking a signal.
Sure. Yeah, excellent point. I would tend to agree, and you seem to have mastered that strategy. Do you have any specific thoughts about the future of the Libertarian Party, or is that something that you've kind of tuned out of? Where do you sit with that?
I'm optimistic about the future for the individuals inside the Libertarian Party. I'm very skeptical of national politics, right? This is kind of one of my core themes, at least national politics for libertarians. You know, that libertarians, you know, rather than trying to persuade everyone, which I think is kind of a fool's, it's good that people attempt it, so I'm not trying to like denigrate the people that do it, but I think it's a bit of a fool's errand for reasons that I don't want to go down that tangent. We can explore that, why I think that, but I think it is a bit of a fool's errand to attempt this. But it really, but the ideas of liberty themselves, I think, are very good. They're very good ideas. And I think they are achievable ideas. And I think the future of the world, not just for libertarians, but for all kinds of ideologies and all kinds of differences, is people moving around and self-selecting and assorting themselves. Because we're lacking in frontiers. We're lacking in the sense of some place you can go that's not been homesteaded, that's unoccupied, where you can go and try something new. And so because we're lacking in frontiers, the only way that you can really achieve something new or something different is to get people who want something different to come together, either online and form a tribe, as someone like Balaji Srinivasan would recommend, or physically, in reality, as the Free State Movement is trying to do with New Hampshire.
So localism is a better solution than trying to change this things from the top down, as we've been saying for such a long time.
Yeah, agree? I'm very, very, very pro localism. You know, I'll tell you a funny story that just popped into my head. I think you guys will like this one. When I was in college, I was very involved with my college radio station, and I had a sort of mentor there who was literally like an open socialist. But he was probably like a left libertarian type. Like, he was very good on your civil rights. And so we found plenty of common ground to get along with. Especially, I was probably a bit more on the left then as well. And I saw him like a decade later. And he always struggled, you know, to change things. But he always had these grand ambitions. But I saw him like a decade later, and he had pivoted, and he had really focused on his block, and he had created this beautiful community garden on his block that was now used by all the people in the community. And I thought it was like such an interesting lesson to see this guy who was a well-intentioned guy, even though I think some of his ideas were naive. And he always struggled to achieve what he was trying, but then when he finally said, "I'm just going to try to improve my block," he succeeded.
Right. Well, that could be a lesson for all of us. In fact, I've been saying for years now, I should be a little more involved locally in my area as well. Although I'm kind of in the belly of the beast here in Sacramento of California, or Clownifornia, as I've been calling it for a while now. But I think there's a lot to be said about that. And, you know, I think that's actually something that came up with Austin last week, is if we were to redirect some of the energy that we put forth on Twitter, trying to get that viral tweet or trying to create that audience of 50,000K, you know, like, things would probably look a lot different. So I'm glad that you brought up that story. And you mentioned a lack of frontiers. Does that mean you're completely dismissing the idea of seasteading, Jeremy? Or is that something that's still...
Oh, no, not at all. I'm so supportive of seasteading. Chad E, I don't want to butcher his last name, but the Chad, he's a real Chad. He's the one who most recently was arrested by persecuted by the government of Thailand. Let's say, this kind of stuff. Patry Friedman's attempts. Startup cities. Yeah, these any attempt to create new frontiers, Liberland, all this stuff is great in the sense of I'm rooting for it. Any given one likelihood of succeeding, I don't know how likely it would be, but you could say the same thing about my own preferred strategy. And so at least, you know, these are, and something that a key test, I think, that all of these meet, which is very important, is to not do the classic definition of insanity, of doing the same thing and expecting different results. And that's very much why I am skeptical of the national persuasion, because this really is, you know, you can see it's the same political fights. More libertarians need to like rewatch debates from the 70s and 80s and, listen to the arguments that were being made at this time. And, you know, the language was a little bit different and the factions were a little bit different, but it's remarkably the same. And the arguments are remarkably similar. And so you can kind of see, you can almost see how similar psychological archetypes, you know, play out and take similar positions throughout history. And, you know, the stage settings may change a little bit and the decorations are different, but it's sort of the same battles.
I agree, man. And it's so frustrating to watch people buy into it over and over and over again, thinking it literally is the definition of insanity. Think repeating the same thing over and over and hoping that something's going to change next time around. And we have guests over and over, you know, on this podcast come on and talk about how they're single issue voters and that's why they're going to vote one way or another, you know, and it doesn't change anything. Well, like what we just saw over the weekend where it was bipartisan support to give Ukraine $60 billion and Israel another $20 billion and Thailand $8 billion. That's almost close to $100 billion toward war. That's guaranteed to provoke world war down the road. And we're spending $100 billion on it as a country. And everybody's pissed at it. No one, you know, no one supports it except for the idiots who are waving their fucking blue and yellow flags, you know, but the majority of Americans don't support that yet. Here they are like, we got to put Trump in there. And at the same time, they have no idea. They have no clue that Trump has got this exact same foreign policy as everything that's going through right now.
You know, the most successful anarchist movement in the United States.
What's that?
Is the Amish. So the Amish physically concentrated in southeastern Pennsylvania. They refused to participate in the draft. They refused to pay Social Security. They said, you can arrest us, send us to jail. And you know what the federal government did? They carved out. They carved out for the Amish. The Amish do not have to pay Social Security. They're one of the few, very, very small number of groups in America that are exempted from having to pay Social Security. And this is, the government has a very, and power generally, has a very sour grapes attitude about how it's exercised. Because key to having power is people believing that your power is effective and can be wielded. So any situation that would reveal that your power cannot be wielded, it's very important for people to believe that you simply didn't want to wield your power in the first place. That's why you see, it's remarkable. You could see the same dynamic at play even at something like another successful anarchist movement, which was Chaz. You know, they successfully took over several blocks of an American city for a decent period of time. You know, they did have control, physical control over that area for some time period. It was a at least a moderately successful insurgency.
Yeah, but it was run by the wrong side.
I don't disagree.
The leftists fucked that up quickly, man.
I'm having some fun with this, you know. I like to.
I wanted to get back to libertarianism a bit because you've had over the past couple of days some interesting tweets about it. And in fact, in a tweet yesterday, you responded to a question from the economist Bob Murphy asking if you were a libertarian. And your response was, my politics are something like minimum viable libertarianism. Idealistically, I am absolutist about private property and voluntary interaction, but I find many libertarians to be delusional about realities of human nature and why they've lost so long. And I think you were just kind of touching on that, but there's another tweet that you had that kind of, I think, went a little bit further. And personally, I kind of tend to think of myself as being maybe a bit too optimistic at times about human nature. So I'm curious to hear more about this and have you expand on this. Just to make sure I haven't, you know, fallen victim to the delusional thinking as well. But, yeah. You know, I should mention that, yeah, you had a screenshot that was talking about the typical mind fallacy that read, a typical mind fallacy is the mistake of making biased and overconfident conclusions about other people's experience based on your own personal experience, a mistake of assuming that other people are more like you than you actually are, which seems similar to kind of like the Dunning-Kruger effect to a degree, but... you follow up the screenshot by saying, I've spent the last 10 years trying to spread awareness of this phenomenon to libertarians and will probably be doing it until I die. So, you know, as we preface the show noting, you're quite critical of the modern day libertarians and rightfully so in many ways. You know, if we've kind of struggled to really gain any ground or produce anything, you know, any type of pushback against the ruling class. But do you think you could explain your point that you're trying to convey there?
Totally. And actually, one, I do think at times I perhaps am too pessimistic. So I'd like to say I am optimistic about the future of liberty. I like libertarians and liberty generally. And I like the idea that we can win. And I think we have a beautiful philosophy and I want us to win. But to sort of get, here's a way of getting to the heart of what I want people to reconcile. If you're a libertarian, there was some journey that you went on to embrace, especially if you're like listening to libertarian podcasts and this kind of thing. There is some journey that you went on that was so persuasive to you that really made you fall in love with these ideas. And it could be different things for different people. For some people, it was, you know, Friedman or Rand or Rothbard or Adam Smith or who knows, you know, the Free Thought Project, whatever it is. But that same thing, you can get that same thing to play out for others. You could get your friend or your brother or sister or whoever to read those same books or engage with the same material, and it simply doesn't resonate with them. The things that were so persuasive to you just weren't persuasive to others. And I think the simplest way of reconciling this is that, well, they're different from you. that because you have certain values and certain perspectives, certain things feel really true to you, but they don't to others. And by the way, I want to emphasize, I think sometimes some libertarians see me making these things and they therefore think that like I don't believe in the ideas or whatever. They resonate with me completely. And that's what I was trying to say with this, is that with the minimum viable libertarianism, like I am, if I could have my ideal society, I would be, you know, as absolutist about voluntarism, that things should be mutually agreed and so on. But man, if you believe that and you go to someone who's like a big fan of Social Security or like something trivial, like, you know, well, like, well, why can't I opt out of it? You know, people will just they'll get dumbfounded by your arguments, maybe, but they won't agree with you at the end of it, right? Because they simply don't actually hold that as an ethical premium. They simply are comfortable, and so that can be a bit alienating, maybe, to face, or hard for people to face this idea that, you know, I think I this is another one of my provocative takes, but what something I've compared it to is like discovering that you're gay, because, you know, I admit to having no subjective experience here, but like you have these feelings inside yourself, and of course you want to believe that they're natural and other people have them. And then you realize that they're not, and only a small percentage of people have them. Mm-hmm. And where do you go from there? To me, I think it's like, well, so what? You should be, even if it's only a couple percent, so what? I feel this way. I'm me. I'm proud of myself. I'm not ashamed of being a libertarian. I'm not going to like put my tail between my, right? I would have been the guy, if I was a gay guy, I would have been the guy like swinging my dick in the gay parade in 1970s. Like, you know, but, you know, so that's how I want to, I'm not going to apologize for it. I'm not going to hold back. I'm going to say what I believe. And the people who like it are going to be attracted and we'll find each other. But that does make me, and this is where I would say some libertarians would want to argue with me, because like they're really convinced that their morality is absolutely correct. And they are kind of universalists. Like they think that if other people don't, I'm going to be honest, like when you give me, again, because I have these intuitions, when you give me the logical argument for the nap and how we shouldn't aggress and so on and forth, I'm like, yeah, I agree. But like, if I want to find peace in the world and an ability to live by my values, I think that I'm better off making the kind of like gay argument. I'm not here to threaten you. I just want to be able to live the way that I want to live, not to take away your right to live the way you want to live. I just want to live the way that I want to live. And like, that's a much more permissive thing, because if you're going around and saying, some libertarian, I'm morally correct, you are a bad person for supporting Social Security. 98% of Americans support Social Security, by the way. So that's why I think it's a fun one to attack, because it's such a popular program. Like almost everyone likes it. Maybe that percentage is a little high, but the data it's a very high number. And so, you know, people think you're a villain. People think you're a bad guy. That's why all these stereotypes, you know, libertarians are, you know, selfish bad guys or whatever. But it's because they don't have that moral intuition. It's not embedded in their value system, and because, you know, something is involuntary or coercive, you know, that's sufficient to, you know, make it bad or wrong.
I agree, man. Nuance is important, especially in situations like these with where we're trying to apply theoretical principles to actual reality that, you know, that we're governed under. So it makes things difficult, especially for the, you know, the Ancapistans who judge everything by the theoretical and not by the actual, you know, the realistic ways in which this is all playing out. And I found myself in that not too long ago with Ron Paul. I mean, this was a fucking long time ago. Who am I saying? Not too long. Like, you know, nearly two decades ago when I started following Ron Paul. And and he was talking about foreign policy and wars and how wrong they were. And you know, how fucked up the U.S. foreign policy was because we're just invading these countries and, you know, blowing people up. And I could not understand how everybody, like literally everybody, even all my family members, left, right, they all supported these wars, you know, in the Middle East. And I'm like, how the fuck can you do, you know, how do you support this? We're killing women and children, you know. And this is well before I got into anarchism and voluntarism. This is just me applying that fallacy that more people, or that I thought people understood things like I did. And, you know, it was through that all the awakening processes that I realized that's not the case at all. If you're principled like that, you know, that's how it goes. There's people that like all cops are bastards or all surgeons, you know, all soldiers are you know, murderers and stuff like that. This is nuanced, dude. Like I was a fucking Marine for 4 years. I would have done anything the state told me to do for anything. I would have killed children if they'd appointed me in front of children, and I would have done that. And it's a damn good thing that I didn't come across a bunch of people who fucking thought I was a bastard or, you know, a murderer, because I would never have broken free from that. I would have divided myself along those ideological lines, and those people would have become my enemy. And I think that that's why this nuance is important and discussions like this are important, is because if we do divide ourselves on these principles without stepping into the other person's shoes, I guess, for a lack of a better cliche, then we end up in these divisive situations and things start to fall apart. And then we have to go into localism and, and, you know, make our block a better place because no one else wants to live on it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I agree totally. It is good to understand the other side and to appreciate their value system. I will say that, speaking personally, sometimes when I empathize with their value system, I end up feeling somewhat alienated from it, because I feel like as I have come to have a better view of what I think some of these people sincerely believe, it does feel alien to me. But here again, I think localism is the solution, because we can separate ourselves and, you know, and if you want to live in this way that feels, you know, morally wrong to me, well, we're separated. And and that also works both ways. I will say it's remarkable, you know, if you've ever tried to talk to someone who really was opposed to libertarian ideas, and they might be, you know, they might really be offended by your arguments or whatever, or not like them or disagree with them. But if you say, well, you know, could I live the way that I want someplace away from you, in a way that wasn't trying to change, you know, what you have and where you are, almost everyone is accepting of that.
You don't have to agree with these people. You just have to not attack them or they shouldn't be able to attack you. So,
well, it's funny. I consider two libertarian thinkers who are regarded very differently to have similar perspectives here, which are Robert Nozick in Anarchy, State, and Utopia, and Hoppe, Hans Hermann Hoppe. Like, they both basically arrive at relatively similar conclusions. People who have read both those books would be very offended by what I just said. And to be fair, to be clear, like, Nozick does remain a minarchist and thinks that there needs to be some like minarchist framework, keeping communities in alignment. I don't even want to argue that perspective necessarily, but like this idea, it's a conclusion that's been come to, you know, by many different libertarian thinkers that this is sort of the right way to go.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you had mentioned that not many people have the same morals that we champion embedded into their value system. And that, I don't know, that just, I tend to agree, but I feel like there is some overlap with some of our first principles, like the non-aggression principle, for instance. So I guess it kind of makes me wonder if, like, obviously you know, somebody like Stefan Molyneux tried to write this, you know, huge, this huge theory argument, you know, universal preferable behavior way back when, and it mostly was denounced because there's just so many moving parts to ethics, right? And to claim it's universal, like that's a tall order. So like, where do you think we go wrong as a species, or are we never even like, are we not born with some of these like ethics already attached to our psyche, or are we propagandized? Are we just not taught like, you know, certain ethics and morals that align with libertarianism? Like, where exactly, like, what did you mean when you said that?
So first, I'm not, just to be clear, when I say that there are some of these differences, I'm not trying to suggest that like a libertarian ought to regard the average person as something like a sociopathic murderer or this like terribly bad person. Sure. You know, we can, and because humans do generally agree on these things, that that your violence is wrong and so on, and don't hurt people and don't take their stuff, right? The classic phrasing of libertarians. Yeah. But part of what is tricky here is that, okay, yeah, if you can go have a man on the street conversation with practically anyone, it's like, do you agree that we shouldn't hurt people and not take their stuff? And, you know, and they'll say yes. And then you say, well, you can explain to them step by step, you know, well, isn't the income tax or isn't whatever hurting people and sure. taking their stuff? And, you know, and it's like, here's another difference between, I think, it's a little bit different about libertarian psychology. The average person just does not have a problem walking around with like 100 different contradictions about what they say that they'll believe. They'll contradict themselves 5 minutes later when polled, and it's like, well, it's not a big deal. You know, and you can like try to get them to argue, but all they'll try to do is reconcile them. They won't really change their opinions. Like yeah. people just have no problem giving contradictory answers. And it's so easy to do this that like it's a whole game in polling that you can literally just ask questions certain way, different ways, and you know, get a 30, 40, 50 different percent response. So so I think part of it is that libertarians are more likely, and this is why in your various psychology profiles, they tend to be systematic, intelligent and systematic thinkers, is like libertarians really are trying to have this view that's like logically consistent, and most people just don't care. Just don't bother.
You know? Okay.
So,
no, go ahead. Keep going.
I forget what else I was going to say. What was the other part of the question?
Well, I think that makes more sense. And I think that certainly clarifies my question. I do want to move on here because I know you are a big proponent of what you've called a libertarian homeland. And I don't know if you happen to see, but like late last year, there was this like creepy Obama produced movie on Netflix called Leave the World Behind. And of course, you know, the conspiracy theorists among us were saying that it's predictive programming, you know, to desensitize and acclimate the masses. And not even 6 months later, here we are. There's another movie out currently right now in the theaters entitled Civil War. And it has like a handful of well-known actors. It seems like it kind of follows the same path as the Obama movie. But it's been out for a few weeks now. It's doing well. And it seems like, you know, either there's a deeper agenda trying to push this like predictive programming, or this is just like an organic market demand for movies on this subject. But do you think if a civil war did break out, do you think this would be the only realistic opportunity to establish a libertarian homeland, or would there be like other criteria that needed to be accomplished for a movement of that size?
So I don't think it necessarily requires that. Although I do think it requires some, not to necessarily exert force, but to have the capacity to exert force. Okay. But I do. I think it's unclear how some of these things will play out. But I think it would be very hard for the United States to actually fight a violent war against American citizens in an era where it's easier than ever to share what's happening. I'd be curious to get your guys' perspective on that point, actually. But my perspective is that social media actually has helped make wars be less, you know, sort of has reduced the atrocities a bit, the kinds of egregious war crimes, because it is easier to capture and prove that soldiers would be doing various things that are immoral. I don't know if that's true. That's like a feeling, so I don't have like some sort of empirical evidence to back that up. Sure. So I'm not going to make that claim strongly. But that would be my that'd be my impression. And so I think you can do it through nullification and through a bit of brinksmanship. But basically nullification and brinksmanship. I think if there ever were a case like that you were getting aggressed against, you do want to have a capacity to defend yourself, but I don't think it is necessary to fight a war against the American government to achieve a space of freedom in the United States. I think it could potentially be done with sort of good political acumen. Not just political acumen, but also the strategy and the way at which you're targeting it. In the case of the Free State Movement specifically, like the federal government, and one of the few ways, in my opinion, the Constitution has held up, is in terms of processes and certain aspects of its design and how it allocates various powers. And that means that if you can actually have a state government that is willing to aggressively nullify federal laws, I think that it would be difficult for the federal government to stop that state.
Sure.
So that's the goal. Like, that would be my optimistic case for the Free State Movement, is that it democratically asserts control over the entire New Hampshire government and uses that government to engage in aggressive nullification strategies against the federal government.
Right. Well, I think you're right about your first assessment there. We've been seeing this. Obviously, we live on social media, Matt and myself, and it seems like you spend a good amount of time on there as well, Jeremy. But I think we could even point to as far back to like 2014 and even probably before that, where there was a huge outcry about Obama bombing Syria and potentially going to war with Syria. And a lot of people point to the protests that popped up rather organically in a very short period of time as to like what actually thwarted Obama's continuation and trying to pursue Syria. And then even more recently with Israel's bombardment of Gaza and Palestine, it seems like more and more people now have kind of condemned Israel's actions and these types of altercations between Palestine and Israel pop up every couple of years, but more so recently, of course, the heavy-handed actions of Netanyahu and everything that's going on over there certainly kind of lends more support and momentum in that direction to oppose Israel. But I think you're absolutely correct about that. And I guess if there was some type of secession or some type of move to actually federally break away from the U.S. government, then that could be potentially a good out. I guess I was just kind of curious, like what the different viable options would be to create a libertarian homeland. And I think you touched on a couple of those. We don't have to keep talking about it, but is there anything else, like any other potential like pathways? I mean, agorism, like creating like parallel economies, that would be something that would have to be so massive to really kind of absorb a state apparatus. I don't know. Is that something that you think is feasible and possible as well?
Yeah. So I think there are all kinds of ways to find freedom in an unfree world. So if your goal is simply personal freedom for yourself, and there's, by the way, nothing wrong with that as a goal whatsoever, I think that agorism, dropout type strategies are relatively sound strategies. If only because I kind of find it fun. I like the idea of like, it's part of why I'm an entrepreneur. I like starting companies and having these large visions and this kind of thing. I like the idea. It's like, what a challenge. The idea of figuring out how to do something that other people haven't figured out is kind of like catnip for me, that's part of why I enjoy engaging in these areas, talking about them. And also, trying to do it by encouraging libertarians to come to New Hampshire and to quite literally take over the state. Like, that is my goal. So other people, by the way, other free staters would disavow these statements, so I'm not speaking on behalf of everyone when I say these things. But I want freestanders in as many positions of power as possible. I mean, so long as they can do the positions morally, at least until they're able to be unwound or reduced or privatized, I want freestaters to become cops. I want freestaters to become public school teachers. You know, I want us to get every position. And there actually are. We now have freestaters in as government attorneys. There is a freestater or two, I think, as a police officer. Freestaters, running some local libraries and stuff like this. And as long as those people are still going to go in and vote to dismantle and vote to, you know, as long as they don't. And that's, of course, the scary part is getting, you know, tempted by the allure of power or staring into the abyss, as it were, or whatever. But assuming that they can hold the line, and I think our culture here is mostly ensuring that these people do hold the line. That's so much better because, you know, even if the school library is to exist, you know, a libertarian's at least going to keep the budget smaller, and he's going to talk to people and try to, you know, convince them to vote. You know, it's now he can put the libertarian books front and center instead of, you know why you're actually three different genders or whatever. You know, I don't know. So by the way, again, people would disagree about this, but that's my vision: is that people come here, they don't drop out, they get involved in their communities, they get involved locally, whatever that might be, planning board, school board, whatever. I was going to say something, but I realized I shouldn't say that one specifically on the show. But anyway, I was going to name another example, but of where someone had gotten involved in a certain way. I mean, we have freestaters who are taking over we've already, I think, largely taken over the Republican Party, though far from entirely, but very influential block there. Freestaters are now moving on to the Democratic Party and just going and running as Democrats. And so it's like, you know, freestaters are everywhere. We've got the press writing articles in addition to the Mother Jones one. You know, the Boston newspapers can't stop talking about how we're like literally murdering democracy in the streets and all this stuff. And it's like, it's not only is it attracting more people here, it's like this keep away sign. You know, like, why would a progressive want to move to New Hampshire, you know, if John Oliver calls it the Texas of New England, which I don't even think is true. It's like Texas kind of sucks for freedom, in my opinion. But it's like the point is John Oliver saying it, which means if you like John Oliver, you don't want to live in the regressive state of New Hampshire. It's like, fine by me. Think we're regressive. I don't care. I just don't want you to come here. that's what I think it's working. Yeah.
Sure. Well, I have another question, but I'm going to save it towards the end. And I was hoping we could maybe move on to a few audience questions because our audience on Twitter actually produced a few really good questions. And a couple of them actually relate to New Hampshire and the Free State Project. So the first one here is, assuming the Free State Project is successful, can you paint a picture for how New Hampshire in 2124 differs from New Hampshire today in 2024?
2124 is very far in the future. So I will, and let me tell you something. I've watched people make predictions in the past. And one of the tricks with predictions is to be very vague about when your prediction is going to happen. So to maximize my own ability to P.T. Barnum in the future, I'm not going to say what year this happens.
Good call.
I want minimum viable libertarianism. So like, I don't really care about arguing whether you can cut out the last 2% of government or not. I would hope that you can, but I don't care about whether we actually do or not. I want schools to be completely privatized. I want there to be no government involvement in schooling whatsoever. Right now, 60% of New Hampshire is schooling. New Hampshire budget is government school. I would like the police to be fully privatized. There's no need, either fully privatized or fully funded at the local municipal level. I would like there to be incredibly strong local rights and abilities for towns to do things. I think more rural areas can go full anarchist, but I think at the scale of a city, you need some sort of local, I prefer private governments, but at some scale, and you can go even smaller than a city here, but at a certain density, you know, people are creating externalities. I don't think you can go full every man for himself style anarchy past a certain density. So you need people to be, you want competing authorities that people can be consenting to, I think is the best you can do at the city scale. And the competition would keep those authorities serving interests rather than, part of the problem is democracy is just a very, McDonald's would be very poorly run if everyone voted on how McDonald's was run. And so all of the city services and so on end up being very inefficient and poorly provided because you're voting for who's the CEO. You want something that's a little bit more capitalistic. I would like New Hampshire to have seceded from the federal government or at least have nullified, sort of the three-letter agencies that would otherwise impinge on free markets. And since we've achieved all those things, I'm very optimistic. So, at this point, New Hampshire is obviously, the leading creator of all biotech, AI, blockchain, whatever future you want to imagine, a single space that's carved out where the global regulatory net of the United States isn't capturing things. It would be remarkable the kinds of things that could be built that people are effectively prohibited from making. And that's part of what I think is so interesting about one of these spaces. I know a lot of people are some libertarians are more on the sort of doomer and collapse side, and I love those guys. I am definitely on the I want to go to Mars side. I want us to be, inventing new things and creating new things. And I see government as so often inhibiting that. And so that's definitely one of the things I really like about the idea of a free New Hampshire is the ability to attract some of the most creative, talented people to come to this space and be even better than Silicon Valley, at this space where things can be done again, and we can have we can have nice things again. We can have a much more functioning society. But I would want there to be very 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 little to no compulsory taxation or payments. And if there are, to the extent that there are payments, you would want there to be a local competition. So if I have to pay some fee, to live, there's at least competition, fee for the services of roads and, the things that some of these goods are hard, and I've read The Block and other arguments for how you do private roads. I'm not saying that they're, impossible. To me, it's I'm a realist. That's why I say, that's why I call it minimum viable. So, you start with the things that are the clearest you don't need. You clearly don't need government involved in the schools, and it's 60% of the government. You clearly don't need Social Security. You clearly don't need this giant war machine. You clearly don't need, and you can just kind of go down the list. And I would save, I would do the minarchist items last, and hopefully you can do them. And we don't have to debate whether we can, whether we need a $100 a year tax for national defense or not. We can just do that last and save that part for last rather than arguing about it up front.
Yeah, that certainly sounds reasonable and pragmatic. And God, I can only imagine what life would look like without government capturing industries, or they really do draw the best out of society as far as some of the smartest people, and then they put them on the taxpayers' tit with the extracted funds, and they tend to maybe not be as productive or innovative as they could be in the marketplace. So I think the world would look a hell of a lot different. So moving on here, imagine New Hampshire could set its own immigration policy. How would you select who could immigrate to New Hampshire? This should be an interesting one. I'd be interested to hear.
I don't actually have the best positive answer to this. Although I will say that immediately makes me want to criticize myself, because I think that people who are critical of things should, when possible, be able to state their positive vision, right? It's very easy to attack things. And so if all you do is attack things, but you can't positively state here's how it should be done, then maybe you're just an asshole, But so I'll say that I think in line with basically everything I've been saying in this podcast, I think people are different and I think people's values do matter. And part of what I care about here is having a space where libertarian values are able to dominate, right? And even if, and I want to be clear, this isn't even necessarily a state thing. Like, so let's imagine we had pure anarcho-capistan, everything is voluntary, it's all voluntary contractual agreements. Even in that framework, I would desire, like, think about what happened during, you know, what happened during COVID, right? And like how, and maybe, and by the way, I do like it when people disagree with me, so feel free to disagree with me. But like, even if the government had done nothing, like people still went crazy. You know what I mean? And obviously the government made it worse. Yeah. But like, I want to, and maybe it's not possible, but like, I want a society where like my elites and my leaders, you know, aren't, even if these are informal elites, I don't mean like elites as like, oh, they're Congress. Like they're going to be people in your society, in your community who others look up to. Who they take their value, and that's perfectly normal and good. Maybe elite is a loaded word for that, but like you, I don't want them to be these like neurotic liberals. Even if the neurotic liberal is going to abide the nap. Like I just don't, you know. So I think our neighbors and these kinds of things they do affect the spaces around us, even if things are as privatized as possible. Like your neighbors matter and these things matter. And so I want to find ways that are consistent with libertarian norms. I'll say this, because this is kind of sounds like I'm just arguing for like a very closed system. I also very much like permissionless systems. I don't like top-down designs. I think any design in which a central authority is setting a quota or is a single central authority is saying yes or no about whether someone can come into your site. I think those are also likely to be poor designs. Sure. But I think you want, and so this is, maybe I'm describing a system that's not possible, but I think you want a system that's like relatively permissionless, but I think you also want a system that's not naive about the fact that people can come with externalities. And that, so I hopefully your permissionless system would, you know, so they're invite type designs. I like things in that direction because they're someone who is within the system can say, I am to some extent vouching my own credibility that the person I'm inviting into this system will also participate in a pro-social way or in accordance with the system's values. So I like things in that direction, but I don't have a highly specific proposal for what New Hampshire's policy would be. I am worried, idealistically, I get the argument for open borders. Realistically, what I see as New Hampshire, like we are playing this game where what matters is what percentage of the state is libertarian. And as that number goes up, our situation improves. And as that number goes down, our situation is getting worse. I don't want to violate libertarian principles necessarily to keep that number. But like if we have an order of how we're changing our policies and so on, like I would certainly be considering that figure. And as I said, the reason I say minimum viable libertarianism is if libertarianism prescribes something that itself would destroy libertarianism, then I'm sorry, but I'm going to throw that part away. Like I don't see the point of to me, this is not something that I have to have so perfect that if there was something that in fulfilling its own purported value system, it destroys itself. I would get rid of that part. And I'm not saying specifically what that is. There's not something I'm dancing around here either. Sometimes people like want to allege there's something I won't say. I'm trying to speak quite frankly as I can about complex questions that are unresolved for me, personally.
Sure. And this is obviously like a very loaded topic with tons of nuance involved. But I think one thing we could agree on is that putting military on our borders probably isn't going to be the solution, which was something that Dave Smith recently said in a tweet. And I had a problem with that, which, you know, obviously would expand government and create a whole host of other issues and problems. But it sounds like a lot of what you're saying kind of goes hand in hand with this other question, and maybe this will be the last audience question before we get close to wrapping it up here. But it sounds like it's the ethics of group discrimination And the question was like the ethics of group discrimination and why libertarians struggle with this psychologically. So, you know, as libertarians, like we have the right to associate with whoever we want, right? How do we make that discernment, and why do libertarians struggle with this?
So, So I sometimes attract, and I don't know who this question is from, I'm not saying anything about this person, but like, I am willing to talk, about groups because I think it's necessary. And also I think if there are true things that are taboo to say, I'm in a position where I'm afforded the ability to say them. I've literally designed my life so I don't have to keep my mouth shut if I don't want to. And so, you know, that means that that's something that, that I can do that other people can't, and I'm willing to, you know, I'm willing to do it. But I am ultimately always an individualist. So one of my rules of thumb is to treat individuals as individuals and to treat groups as groups. In the case of immigration policy, what this would mean is, if there's a specific individual that we're comparing, we don't really need to give that much weight to the group that he's in, because whatever we care about, we can construct some kind of narrower test. So if we're concerned about there being higher rates of criminality or lower rates of libertarianism or whatever rates you might care about in different groups, well, when you're talking about a specific individual, there's very little to no need to consider his groups whatsoever. You can simply consider, you can simply construct stronger tests. Group membership is always a crude proxy for any specific individual. At the same time, when you're talking about whether you're going to take 1 million people from one country or one place in the world, or 1 million people from another country or another place in the world, it is insane to say that there's no difference between groups. There clearly are differences between groups, you know? And so we have to also be able to talk about that way. So if we're talking about immigration, all immigration is not the same, all right? So I always prefer, it bothers me that libertarians at times don't want to acknowledge certain truths about groups. We should be able to speak plainly about racial differences in the same way that we can speak about differences between men and women. You know, we shouldn't, you know, men are more criminal than women. They're more violent than women. These are facts. Okay. We can talk about why they're true, but we can't really debate that they are true because they're just true. All the evidence says that they're true. There's not really any counter evidence that says that it's not true even. There's just a taboo against talking about it. And, you know, and that to me just makes no sense. And so I will violate that taboo. But when I violate that taboo and talk about groups, because talking about group differences, also the other reason talking about group differences is necessary is if you can't acknowledge that these differences between groups exist, it really looks like people are racist, or it really looks like society is fucked up in these ways that it's just not. And that's the other reason that talking about these group differences is important. But ultimately, whenever possible, and it usually is possible, we don't need to judge people by groups. We can simply judge them as individuals, and we can construct narrower tests for whatever characteristics we care about, and we don't have to rely on group heuristics.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that answer, especially that end part there, and I agree. As we mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, you know, you've essentially established yourself as this provocative figure that pushes the boundaries of accepted libertarian thought, or you've been pigeonholed as this controversial figure. You know, I don't really know which one. I do appreciate that you're challenging the established norms, though, and I think that's, at least, you know, if it is true, even if it is uncomfortable, we should still be able to talk about these things, you know? And so the fact that you're continuing to try to push the ball forward in that sense is something that I appreciate. I don't think, you know, I could really call you a follower, as you've demonstrated that, you know, you have a tendency to blaze your own trail. But I also thought it would be important to kind of give you an opportunity to clear the air if needed be, and share what you believe is maybe the biggest misconception about who you are and what your goals consist of.
Well, I think it's fair to call me controversial because I think objectively I have been there, right? So I don't want to dispute that. I just don't think I can factually dispute that. What I would dispute is that my goal is to cause controversy.
Okay.
My goal is to find the truth. My goal is both to find the truth and to fucking win, quite frankly. Like, I want to win. I want to succeed. I don't, you know, and I don't want to just be in in theory land. So I'd prefer to be known if controversial is going to get attached to me. I could go with some of these other things tagging along with it maybe, but that's my goal. It's probably a bit of my nature, like even from a young age. I'm fairly convinced it's an apocryphal story at this point, but I loved the story of Galileo as a kid, you know, going into the Catholic Church and saying, you know, nonetheless it moves, or yet it moves, at Percy Mwove, and saying, you know, like basically screw you, the earth does go around the sun. So I have always liked that kind of thing. It probably is true that while I'm truth seeking, I also am more likely to talk about things that I think are true where other people might disagree with me. And so therefore that results in controversy, right? But I think that it's not specifically controversy for controversy's sake. It's more a desire to find the truth and looking for, well, what are the things that are true that are the most, you know, not believed? Probably would not surprise you that I enjoyed the Reddit atheism movement of the early 2000s. Although I would, I think that movement also didn't go to very good places, and that taught me some things about human nature. That's what defines me in terms of what I want to achieve. It's what I said. I want to achieve a libertarian homeland. I want to achieve the closest thing to a libertarian society actually existing in the real world. And I want to see if it works or not. I think it will. I think it will be a beautiful thing. I think libertarian ideas are beautiful ideas. I think they work. And I think we deserve an ability to live under them. And I want to be a guy who at least played a role in having that actually happen and having that come to be. I think we can do it, and I think we are doing it, and I encourage people who find that idea exciting to consider being a part of it.
Now, I'd mention one more thing too here, and you know, I tend to believe you, Jeremy, when you say that. I don't think you're being controversial or provocative just for, you know, getting the clicks or getting the eyeballs on you and trying to push your own agenda or your own in-group preferences or any of those things. And the reason why I say that is because things happen behind the scenes that we don't see. You know, not everything happens on Twitter or Facebook or any of these other social media companies. And before we got on the podcast, we were actually talking to Jeremy about the ways prior to when we were censored, as he was trying to get us on his library blockchain site and trying to help us more or less evade some of the censorship and prepare for what was coming. So just with that being said, I do appreciate that you have been a supporter of the Free Thought Project. And I think it's actions like that that really show people's true colors, you know. And if we hadn't had those experiences prior to, maybe, you know, looking at some of the stuff that you do online, maybe I'd have some of these similar opinions as other people about you just being this controversial troll or something, you know. But I could say firsthand that my experiences with Jeremy has been something that, you know, it's proven to me that he does care about the cause. He cares about the free flow of information. He cares about liberty and peace, prosperity, transparency, all that stuff. And I think your work within the blockchain and Odyssey and Library also proves that as well.
I agree.
Thank you very much. Free speech is something I'm very committed to. I believe in so much, even for my enemies, even for the people I disagree with entirely. I still very much believe in and support their free speech. Oh, I also say one other thing. This is people don't see this side of it. Like, people see the takes that go, you know, the hot takes that go viral or generate a lot of controversy. I also will like push back against my audience in much smaller ways, much more unpopular ways with my own audience. Even people don't see that stuff, you know. So it's like, sure, the you end up getting known by like the one or two takes that people see. I think anyone who sees takes from me on the regular would see that I'm I might engage with taboo ideas, but it's not, it's like, you know, it's maybe 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 20. Like, I'm doing a lot of other content. I mean, a bunch of my content's like about how to raise kids, and I think it's like some of the least controversial stuff, you know, you'd find.
All right, free thinkers, this episode is nearing the end. We wanted to take this time to remind you, if you found value in this conversation, please consider hitting that like button and subscribing to the Free Thought Project podcast on your preferred platform of choice. It's an easy, no-cost way to support us and ensure you never miss an episode. Also, the Free Thought Project operates primarily on the generosity of our listeners. If you believe in our mission and support our cause, please consider donating or subscribing by going to the membership tab at the top of our website. Your contributions ensure we are able to continue our important work, having these important conversations, and your donations help us do just that. Lastly, if you're part of an organization or own a business that aligns with our mission and values, we are currently inviting sponsorships for our podcast. This is a fantastic opportunity to promote your product or make your brand visible to our engaged audience while supporting meaningful discourse. Thank you for your support, Freethinkers, and as always, thank you for listening.
Well, brother, we are at the end of the podcast. I know you're very active on Twitter. You also have a website, which is kauffj.com, which looks a bit like your bio of past and present work. But feel free to share with our audience where they could find more of your work and share anything that you'd like to plug.
Yeah, I am definitely the most active on Twitter. And I'm on there at my full name, Jeremy Kauffman, K-A-U-F-F-M-A-N. I am going to be launching something new, but I'm not ready to talk about it yet. I would encourage people to come to Porkfest this June. I'll be there all week if anyone wants to come hang out with me. It's a great chance to check out New Hampshire and the Free State Project for the first time or the third time or the 10th time. It's like it's a very cool – it's almost like it's a libertarian Burning Man kind of thing. So that means it's like a party, but there's a lot more capitalism and a lot more libertarians and a lot more guns. But it's people hanging out in the woods, having a good time. You can also get hotel rooms and stuff, but I camp, and it's just a blast. So I'll be there all week. People can come out then, or come to New Hampshire anytime. Anyone who's curious, curious about New Hampshire, wants to visit, feel free to reach out to me directly, DM me, send me an email, you know, whatever. And I'm happy to spend time with anyone personally that is curious about what we're doing here.
Man, I would love to make it out to Porkfest. In fact, I was invited to speak this year and it just didn't work out. But hopefully next year, hopefully in the future, hopefully it's both me and Matt. We can make a trip out there one of these days and shake your hand. But I know you've been a longtime supporter of our work, which, you know, I mentioned a few minutes ago, and everything you've done to try to help us archive all of our articles and everything. Very much appreciated. So, you know, it was important for us to finally connect with you after all these years. And I wanted to learn more about you as a person too, because as we were just saying, you know, sometimes it's just the buzz and the hype and all the mischaracterizations and that kind of stuff that people end up kind of hearing about. So I wanted to really get it from the horse's mouth and pick your brain about some of these things. So yeah, thank you for your unconventional, I guess, views on a lot of this stuff to ultimately stimulate conversation and attempt to move the ball forward in the right direction. And yeah, your commitment to liberty, man, has been inspiring. So thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you.